Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, joined as always by Frank Cogliano. How you doing, Frank?
David, I'm great. Thank you. All the better for seeing you.
All right. For the past 2 weeks, at least, Congress has been consumed with the debt limit debate. And I guess yesterday they passed a brief extension of the debt limit into December. But we will have another debt limit debate, I guess, in December. This is one of many debates in recent years over the debt limit. And so we thought we'd spend today talking about debt and how the United States has dealt with debt and how we can get out of this sort of vicious cycle of debt cycle debates, which is not the debates I think necessarily the country needs to be having right now.
Yeah, I think we need to preface our comments, David, by stipulating at the outset that we are not economists, as we're about to demonstrate over the next few minutes. So our expertise when it comes to the mechanics of this, I think, is limited.
To be sure. But also, like many people we're going to be talking about today, are also not economists, and that may explain some of the choices they made historically and otherwise.
Yeah, indeed. I think one of the things we're seeing in this debate, and I'm using the term debate advisedly, is we have a lot of people who don't necessarily understand the implications of what they're doing, taking us to the precipice.
Yeah, I mean, of the things that Congress is dealing with and the country is dealing with, the debt limit doesn't seem like a very sexy topic, but the consequences of messing this up are huge.
That's right.
And now the debt's really old, right? If we talk about the national, I mean, the debt actually sort of predates the United States. Do you want to talk about the sort of the origins of the national debt, Frank?
Sure. I mean, you're right. Well, it certainly predates the origins of the United States under the current Constitution.
Yes.
I mean, the debt goes back as to the very beginning of the Republic, because there was a debt. The states, both individually and collectively as a union or a confederation, amassed a significant debt in waging the War of Independence. And the consequences of the debt, the consequences of that debt, were one of the things that drove the movement to create the new Constitution back in the summer of 1787. Historians, we don't need to belabor this today, I don't think, but there's a debate among historians as to how severe the economic crisis of the mid 1780s was. But what seems beyond dispute is that there was an economic crisis in the mid-1780s, and it partially revolved around questions of debt. So Shays' Rebellion was a debtor's rebellion, for example, in Massachusetts in the autumn of 1786, for example, which is usually seen as one of the precipitating events for the Constitutional Convention. When we get the new government created under the Constitution, of course, Alexander Hamilton, he of Broadway fame, was the first Treasury Secretary, and Hamilton, one of the very first tasks that Washington set him as president, and one of the first things that Hamilton recognized he had to do, was get on top of the question of debt, and he wrote his famous report on public credit. And what Hamilton's plan was, and again, I'm going to simplify a pretty complicated plan, was essentially, we're going to aggregate all the debt of the states, as well as the public debt of the United States as an entity, and the federal government will take all this on, and this will become the debt of the United States. And the reason for this, well, there are several reasons for it. One is he felt the debt had to be paid, and it was owed, that original debt was owed to some foreign countries, particularly France and as well as the Netherlands, but also it was owed to speculators within the United States. The debt had originally, a lot of it had originally been held by soldiers in the Continental Army, but they'd sold their debts on to speculators, and there was a debate at the time about whether that debt needed to be honored, and Hamilton's view was we need to honor the entire debt, the reason being we need the support of those speculators if this government's going to work. So the kind of guys who had the foresight to buy up that debt in the 1780s are exactly the kind of people whose support the government needs. Hamilton's model in all of this was Britain, and Britain's success, particularly as Hamilton saw it, the Bank of England played a key role, and Britain's ability to borrow, and that meant going into debt, to finance its expansion in the 18th century was a model that should be followed by the United States. As I said, I'm greatly simplifying a complicated economic history and financial policy, but that's the very, you'll be happy to hear, brief version of this.
But the interesting thing that Hamilton is making is he's saying, look, we need to create a bond between the people who hold government debt and the government itself. That makes a state. And so there are bonds through bonds, right? You're making you know, that there will be...
Oh, David, you punster.
That's about the extent of the... Yeah. We're doing national debt here, Frank. I got to stretch here.
We can laugh because there's credit.
Yeah. But that there was an advantage to the country to feel like they had an investment in legal way, but in a financial stake in the future of the government. I think that was part of Hamilton's argument. Now, not everyone in Washington's cabinet, my memory serves correctly, was a huge fan, though, of this idea.
No. So you might have heard of the guy named Thomas Jefferson.
May have come up once or twice in the past podcast. Tell me about this Jefferson guy.
Well, Jefferson was the Secretary of State, of course, during this period when Hamilton was producing this. Hamilton produced a series of reports outlining the kind of economic future of the United States. And Jefferson was the Secretary of State, and he was very, very suspicious of this. There's a regional aspect to this. Again, we don't really want to belabor it now, but many southern states had paid off their war debts when some of the northern states had not yet. And so when Hamilton proposes to take on not just the federal, the debts of the national government, but also the debts of the state governments and kind of aggregate them into one national debt, there was opposition from the South, including Jefferson's Virginia, to this. Jefferson's skeptical about debt. He's a farmer. Well, he's a planter. That's a big
Yeah, exactly.
His well-being depends on agriculture, right? And people who depend on agriculture in this period go into debt routinely, mm-hmm. whether they're small farmers in Massachusetts like the Shaysites who rebelled in 1786 or big plantation owners like Jefferson and Washington, because they have to borrow because the money only comes mm-hmm. in intermittently. And consequently... the kind of Jeffersonian Republicans, as they will become known, are very skeptical about debt. They fall prey to the thinking that one hears in political discourse today, like you can't have a national debt because you couldn't have your own individual debt as a householder. We hear this, you know, it's kind of kitchen table argument. You have to balance the books, and so he's very, very skeptical about debt. He's terrible at money.
Yeah, I was thinking, it's like he almost goes bankrupt. Like,
yes, and he, in part, it's not his fault because he co-signs for people who are...
So he makes some bad choices.
He makes some bad decisions, but he dies in debt. One reason he can't do anything, and this is an excuse that's often proffered by his defenders about the people he enslaved, is because he was in debt. Anyway, that's a different podcast. No. The point being, he's very skeptical about debt, doesn't necessarily have a very good understanding of fiscal matters, but... his political faction, the Jefferson, we'll call them the Jeffersonian Republicans for the sake of simplicity, had as a kind of article of faith that public debt was a bad thing and should be kept to a minimum. And so Hamilton's more ambitious plans for public borrowing, which would allow for a stronger, more robust federal government, are anathema to Jefferson and his supporters, including James Madison, who leads the opposition in the House of Representatives at the time. What we see, however, David, is once Jefferson becomes president, he starts to see the virtue of public debt.
I want to buy Louisiana. I need some money.
Exactly. And in part because his Treasury Secretary, Albert Gallatin, who's a Swiss-born man from Pennsylvania, but a pretty astute... Gallatin deserves a better reputation, a kind of more prominent reputation than he has, because in many respects, he is the successor to Hamilton. Hmm. And Gallatin convinces Jefferson, actually, the debt isn't as bad as you think it is. And Jefferson moderates his opposition to the public debt once he himself becomes president, as you say, because you want to do things like buy Louisiana or wage war in North Africa and all the things that he ends up doing. And so... But what we see, and this is important for our discussion about more contemporary issues, is the debt becomes partisan from the start. Mm. It's an object of political differences, and people are ascribing to it. What we have is we have the debt as an economic factor, or a thing. That's the actual debt, and there are the politics around the debt. And I think if we look back to the very origins of the national debt, it was political from the outside. I think that's the takeaway, not whether Jefferson understood fiscal policy or not. And I think that's what we've seen. Mm. But we need to get out of my period, I think, David. Let's go into your period, because what happens to it during the 19th century?
Well, there's one moment, and I think this is a continuation of the Jeffersonian ideal that the debt is bad, both on a policy way and in a moral sense.
It's a moral thing. It's like, that is morally bad.
Yeah. Well, and I wrote about this some in my first book. Southerners, and especially planters, saw debt as bad because debt made you seem subservient to somebody else.
Right.
And so there are ways in which sort of metaphorically that made you enslaved to somebody else, which, you know, fed into all kinds of questions about honor. There is one moment that I think is really critical for understanding, and that's the one time when the United States didn't have a national debt. And that's for a very brief period in 1835 under Andrew Jackson. Because Jackson, like Jefferson, abhorred the debt. He thought the debt was repugnant. He thought it was immoral. He thought it was immoral for individuals to people to be in debt, but he thought, you know, by extension, it was immoral for the country to be in debt. In part because he said, like, look who is benefiting from the debt. It's wealthy bankers in New York and London, these elitists who don't understand the common people, and they are controlling behind the scenes the government because they control the debt.
Which Hamilton would have said had he been alive. That's the point.
Right, exactly. But, you know, if we think about Jackson's financial thinking, his hatred of debt helps to make sense of some of his other choices. Yep. He, you know, he hated the Second Bank of the United States, which is sort of the descendant of the bank that Alexander Hamilton created. So he has the bank war, which everyone knows about. He engages in Indian removal. One of the ways in which Jackson decides to fight the debt is by selling off as much government land, parenthetically Native American land, as he can. He also vetoes lots of spending programs, and part of it, he has sort of constitutional defenses for vetoing internal improvements, but it's also, he wants to cut federal spending so he can spend all the money that they're getting from tariffs and from other sources of income, like selling the land, to pay off the debt. At one point in time, more than half of federal expenditures are going towards paying off the debt. And on the 1st of January, 1835, they say, look, we have now paid off all of our debt. He says, like, we are going to never have a debt again. This is going to be great. This is going to be a moment of enormous prosperity. And, you know, everybody can thank me now. Turns out to be a financial disaster. There's an enormous panic that hits 2 years later. And the relationship between getting rid of the debt and the panic is complicated. But what some people have postulated is one of the factors that leads to this enormous depression that starts in 1837 and lasts for the better part of 5 or 6 years is that without a very reliable place to put your money, and government debt is a reliable place to put your money, both then and now. If you want like the place to put your money where you know it's going to be safe, you put it in government securities. If without those government securities, where else are you going to put your money? You're going to put it in banks? And he'd already just killed the national banks. So the only banks that can put money in are these sort of local banks, which weren't government secured like they are today. A lot of those banks go under. You invested in real estate. There was a huge land bubble and that crashed. So it actually led to financial instability because there was no longer any national debt. And consequentially, you know, when the economy crashed, there was a huge national debt then again. So there are consequences. You know, you might think paying off the debt's a good thing, much like paying off your, you know, mortgage or paying off your car loan is a good thing. But actually having a debt there serves an important role for the economy as a whole, not just for the government.
Right. Well, it gives the government the ability to spend. That's really what it is, and it's fiscal flexibility. So provided it's not so large that that it destroys the government, it actually, it provides fluidity.
It provides fluidity for the government, but it also provides sort of a rudder for the entire economy because it allows you, you know, when you're panicked about the economy as a whole and you say, well, look, the stock market, you know, today, if you look at the stock market's looking bad, the bonds are bad, I'm not sure about investing in X, Y, or Z, you can always put your money in a government bond and think, I'm going to get a lousy rate of return, but I know it's going to be safe for the time.
I'm going to get a rate of return
because the government is a sure bet.
And I'm glad you mentioned, I'm not glad you mentioned Indian removal. I don't want that misconstrued.
It's important that I mentioned
Indian removal. No, but the land issue is an important one because in Jefferson's thinking, you're right, Jefferson's kind of economic thinking and Jackson's are very similar. And Jefferson's solution when asked, okay, well, how are we going to fund the government? Where's our revenue going to come from? He too was an enthusiast for selling Western land, for which Reed native land. So that's another parallel. Okay, David. So we have that moment in the 1830s. The big expense in the 19th century. Civil War.
The war is very expensive, but it also changes.
How'd they pay for it?
Well, so Lincoln gets together with the Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon Chase, in 1861. Right as the war breaks out, he says, "Hi, we're going to need a lot of money. Right, we're going to need to figure out a way to finance this." And Chase writes basically said, "Well, we got some choices. We're going to have to raise some taxes." And they raise the tariff, they create an income tax, but that's only going to be able to fund some stuff. We're going to be able to sell off some lands, but not enough and not quickly enough. What we need to do is we need to basically sell bonds. And so his plan basically is for 2/3 of the expense of the war is going to sell through bonds. And obviously in 1861, they don't know how long the war is going to last. They end up having to spend a lot more than they anticipated. But his initial plan is we go sell bonds and raise the money that way. Lincoln says, fine. Chase goes to the place where you go to sell bonds. That is to say, he went to New York, and he went to Boston, he went to Philadelphia, and he went to bankers. And he said, "Hi, I'd like to sell you some government bonds. Are you interested?" And those bankers, many of them, had connections with the cotton industry, with planters. They weren't entirely sure they wanted to buy those bonds. They said, we're not sure first that you're going to win this war. We're not sure that we want to alienate our friends, you know, the cotton factors in New Orleans and other places. And so they only end up giving Chase about half as much money in loans as he wanted, and they don't give him at very good rates. And this actually causes some pretty substantial public backlash, because people say, look, these are bankers who are not being patriotic, right? They are not, you know, showing that their love of country is before their love of their own profits. Which leads to a real change in how bonds and government debt is understood. Because in 1862, a financier by the name of Jay Cook goes to the government and says, look, instead of selling bonds to bankers and to banks, how about we sell bonds to the American people directly? And he sets up this system of agents, and he has 2,500 agents spread across the country who are in charge of selling bonds to whoever wants to buy them in fairly small denominations, as small as $50, which was then still a sizable amount of money, but it wasn't these huge thousands and thousands of dollar bonds that were sold to banks. And he sold it as a product, right? So they had ads in newspapers, they had fairs where they sold bonds, they went door to door sometimes. They had competitions between different cities. They said, Cleveland, Cincinnati is buying more bonds than you. Are you going to let them, you know, claim that they are more patriotic than you are? And so they sort of sold the bonds and buying bonds as a patriotic part of Americans' duty to their country. They say, look, you may not be on the front lines fighting this war, but you can contribute to the war and to this government. And you can help out your son or your brother or your cousin who's off doing the fighting by buying a bond from us. And that really sort of fundamentally changes the whole dynamic of who owns government bonds. And to be sure, after that, there's still a whole bunch that's held by banks and by, you know, foreign corporations and what have you. But this idea that the public is invested in government bonds also becomes part of the story.
So, David, this is a sidelight, but it's an important one. And I know we have to move on. How did the Confederacy pay for the war?
Oh, they had a lot of difficulty. Both sides had a lot of difficulty paying for the war. The Confederacy also tries to raise money through bonds. They try to borrow money in London. The Lincoln administration also tries to borrow money in London. They borrow money from Southern banks, those that exist. They also did this thing where they're causing people, they're selling bonds to Confederate citizens, if that's a thing that we can talk about. They also printed a lot of paper money, just a huge amount of paper money, so much so that there's hyperinflation in the Confederacy in its final years, where, you know, a barrel of flour that would have cost, you know, $20 at the beginning of the war is selling for $500. And so, yeah, they print a lot of paper money.
And I mean, we need to talk about what happens to the debt of the United States after the war. But again, very briefly, what happened to the debts of the Confederacy at the end of the war?
Well, so this brings us to the 14th Amendment.
Right, yeah, sorry.
Because this is a real key element. Because at the end of the war, there are these huge debts. There are lots of papers circulating, both from the United States and from the Confederacy and from various state governments that say, look, this is a bond that's due at such and such a rate whenever. Part of the debate that happens at the end of war is what's going to happen to those debts. And that's one of the things that gets addressed in the 14th Amendment, which is the most complicated of the three Reconstruction Amendments. So there's these three amendments. There's the 13th Amendment, which ends slavery. There's the 15th Amendment, which is about black suffrage. The 14th does a bunch of things. It's equal protection. It's citizenship. But one of the clauses, and this is a clause that often gets neglected over these other elements of the 14th that are important, it says the following. The validity of the public debt of the United States, authorized by law, including debts incurred by payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state shall assume or pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss or emancipation of any slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void.
So the Confederate debts are void.
All Confederate debts are just worthless. Those pieces of paper are good for kindling and nothing else.
I don't want to belabor this because it's a slight distraction from the object at hand, but did any of the former states of the Confederacy try to honor their debts?
Oh, to be sure.
This
is a period of time in which Southern states are trying to resist Reconstruction through legal...
They want to maintain slavery if they can.
I mean, this is at the point in which there's Klan violence, there's active rebellion against the federal government in a variety of large and small ways throughout the South. So yeah, they try to wiggle their way around this, but the Constitution is very clear that the U.S. debt is somewhat sacred. Like, it shall not be questioned. And Confederate debts and debts about slavery are just gone. And I think that might have consequences for our conversation later on. When we get to the actual sort of debt ceiling itself, though, I guess that doesn't really... We don't get a debt ceiling in our modern iteration until World War I. Do we want to...
Yeah, I mean, we could briefly talk about this. I guess... Even the cost of the Civil War, throughout from 1789, when the new Constitution took effect, until 1917, Congress theoretically had to approve every increase, every debt individually that the United States incurred. I think part of this arises simply, it's a constitutional question, isn't it? It's because of checks and balances. So the Congress has the authority over the budget, but the Treasury is part of the executive.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a tension there. And then in 1917, we get the Liberty Bond Act. So again, trying to fund a war and the entry of the United States into a war. Congress basically approves aggregating the debt. I mean, they'll do this will take greater form or take a more formal, kind of more institutional form in the Second World War, 1939 or 41. But basically what starts in 1917 is Congress aggregates the debt and creates a kind of national debt, but increases in that debt have to be approved. It sets a limit on debt, I should say, and that limit has to be approved.
So, what had been happening up to that point is the Congress under Article 1, Section 8, which says Congress can borrow money. Congress was actually figuring out the interest rates on these bonds. They're like, right, we're going to buy a boat and we're going to have to issue some bonds for it. And the bonds are going to be for 15 years and it's going to be at 3% interest and it's going to be paid off in this way, And if you read the debt legislation from the 19th century, they are really sort of in the weeds about how they are going to pay for, how these bonds they're doing all the work themselves. Right. And then I think, with the second Liberty Bond Act of 1917, Congress is like, look, this bond stuff is really complicated. We're not economists. we don't know how to sort of navigate the intricacies of interest rates and how long these things should be and whatnot. Treasury Department, you do it.
Yep.
And so basically since 1917, the Treasury Department has been dealing with the bonds, and the Treasury is saying, well, how many bonds do we issue? And the debt limit initially is about Congress saying up to X amount you can issue.
Basically, yes. Yeah. Congress is setting the limit that the Treasury can borrow, but allowing the Treasury to figure it out.
Exactly. So the fight we're having right now is one that actually has this sort of origins in the First World War, sort of. But we don't have huge political fights over the debt limit really until the 90s, I don't think.
Yeah, and not kind of ones with possible apocryphal consequences until the past decade, really. I mean, so Congress has had to routinely vote to approve raising the debt ceiling, raising the debt limit, about 100 times in the past century. It's done so 78 times since 1960, so it's become more common in recent decades than it was in the first 50 years or 30 or 40 years of that period. And so what we've seen is this has become a more regular feature of American politics, I think. To get the stats right, it's been raised 49 times under Republican presidents and 29 times under Democratic presidents. And I think we started to see real budget fights, you're right, in the 90s, but they've really picked up in intensity. The aughts were a little bit exceptional because of 9/11 and the war on terror. I think that there was no way that the Democratic opposition to George W. Bush, you know, basically both parties agreed, give them as much money as they need to wage the war on terror. So there was a little bit of a hiatus, I think, in the aughts, and then it really took off in the past decade. You look like you want
well,
to
say
Well, I
mean, something. I think it's a weapon, if that's the right
it's
word.
It's become a weapon.
It's become a weapon. That's really only largely used by Republicans, which is to say that, you know, the first time we see it is in 1995 when the government shut down, debt ceiling's linked to that. And that's because it's a tool that Republicans can use to say, look, unless you give in to whatever our demands are, we're not going to authorize the raising of the debt ceiling, in which case all hell breaks loose. I think it's probably worth explaining what would happen if we reach the debt ceiling.
Well, if we breach it.
Yeah.
Well, in the first place, the cost of borrowing for the United States government would go through the roof. And that may not sound like it matters, but it does. The government would actually have to decide whether it was going to pay its debts, which it's legally obliged to do. So, because the debt ceiling is actually the agreement to pay for things you've already voted on.
Yeah. So it's not about choosing whether to buy the color TV on the credit card. It's choosing whether to pay the credit card bill after you've already got the TV.
Right.
So it's
which means if you do that, you can't necessarily buy groceries for tomorrow.
Right.
So for example, the United States wouldn't be able to make Social Security payments.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be able to pay its huge military. It wouldn't be able to pay their salaries. Right. It wouldn't be able to operate. And not in a, we've had these occasional budget crises where we get shutdowns for 2 or 3 weeks. And there's a little bit of, you know, West Wing style drama. You know, it's not like that. It would be much worse than that. But even more serious than that, David, is the fact that it would crash the global economy because the dollar is still the kind of currency that that is the cornerstone of the global economy. It gives the United States incredible influence, you know, as a consequence. But you know, the United States would not be a reliable economic player, and the consequences would reverberate around the globe. And the full faith and credit, to use the expression, of the United States would be called into question. It would trigger an economic catastrophe within the United States, but it would have global consequences that are virtually unthinkable. And I think one reason the debt ceiling has always been raised as a result of this, so the debt limit is always raised when we get to these moments historically, is because, you know, the people in the Treasury make clear to the people in Congress that this is what will happen. You are correct, though, that this has happened, that Republicans have been more willing to use this as a weapon than Democrats have. And I think there's a couple of reasons for that. So the figure I gave you before, since 1960, it's been raised 78 times, 49 under Republican presidents, 29 under Democrats. In part, it gets raised under GOP presidents because GOP president, when there's a Republican in the White House, Democrats go along with this because, first of all, they want government to function. Republicans, certainly in the last 40 years, since the Reagan Revolution, and we talked about this last week with Sarah, are committed to this small government ideology. You know, in some formulations, they want government so small you can drown the baby, you know, in the bath or whatever. So they have a kind of anti-government, there's an anti-government element in the Republican Party that doesn't care. Or would care because of the economic consequences, but is skeptical about big government. It also feeds, it's good politics for them because it's kind of article of faith on the right in the United States that Democrats are profligate spenders. And although this is not spending, or basically this is agreeing to pay your credit card bill, it's not new spending. It looks like new spending. So I think the politics of the current moment, for example, where we're I think it could be economically catastrophic and politically catastrophic for the United States to breach the debt ceiling in December. But it's good politics for Mitch McConnell and the GOP, especially when what people are hearing about is a debate about $3.5 trillion in spending in the infrastructure bill and the spending bill. Because most people aren't disentangling all this. They're you're seeing it on social media or hearing it, hearing all these figures bandied about. And you say, oh, well, they approved $3.5 billion and $1 trillion in spending and then the economy crashed. That's how it will look.
Yeah.
And so it's
having the economy crash when there's a Democrat in the White House plays well for them politically.
Yeah, but it's not even that simple. I think there's an ideological aspect.
Yes, too, right.
And I think, with respect, and this is bipartisan, but I think it's a bigger problem on the GOP side at the moment. The current crop in Congress are not the most brilliant people who've ever served in Congress. And I think, I'm thinking of Marjorie Taylor Greene and well, there's
Madison Cawthorn.
Yeah, Madison Cawthorn. Ted Cruz has been talking about this, and he does. I don't think they understand I simply don't think they understand the consequences.
They think their constituents don't.
Right, and I do think it is good politics. So this is the danger. It's good politics for them.
You know, the point which if I'm trying to think of when does this start, when does this sort of demonization of the national debt and then sort of the fight over the debt ceiling was the moment for me when it starts is when there's installed in Times Square in 1989 the national debt clock.
Yeah.
They had this huge looked like a digital clock counting up the national debt, and every time you went by it the national debt was
higher. Going up,
and it was some astronomically large number, and it's of an order of magnitude that none of us can understand because we don't deal with numbers like that in our daily lives, and it seems like a huge problem that we need to deal with, when in fact it's not a problem necessarily we have to deal with. Having a national debt in and of itself is not the problem. Not paying the national debt paying off, because one of the things that would happen if we don't pay the national debt is there are going to be a huge number of lawsuits against the federal government from people who say, you owe me money and you have not paid me, and that's going to be from people who hold federal credit instruments, treasury bills and bonds. It's going to be from people who are receiving Social Security or not getting their Social Security payments. It's going to be from military contractors. It's going to be from active duty soldiers. It's going to be from everybody. Only people who are guaranteed to be paid?
Lawyers.
Well, obviously, yeah.
It's always lawyers.
The president and the members of Congress. Because the Constitution says they're going to be paid for their services. But everybody else, they can potentially cut out of the loop.
Well, and there's just a danger of this. So I think it's really turned toxic in the past decade. And this became a real political weapon that Republicans used first against President Obama, and now they're using it against President Biden. So in 2011, we had a crisis over this, which you undoubtedly remember. They went to the brink in 2011. The United States the nation's credit rating was downgraded for the first time ever as a result of going to the brink in 2011. And
that cost us a lot of money.
$1.3 billion just in additional costs for paying the debt.
For almost not paying our credit card bill. Right? Yes.
Letting it go to the last day.
Exactly.
But I think, again, that was a moment when this became weaponized. Mm. And I think, and this kind of game of chicken of going right to the precipice, really amped up. And then we saw it again in 2013 when they tried to defund the Affordable Care Act. We went again under President Trump. It was less of a problem because I think they raised it three times under President Trump, if memory serves, including making a deal in 2019 not to do it for two more years. Mm. And that deal just expired this summer, and so, which is why we're in the mess we're in now. But in part, as I said, it's not that Democrats necessarily understand the economy better than Republicans. I think the Democrats in Congress don't want the government to.
They believe default. They believe in a working government is good. Yeah.
And so they've tended to go along with it. I mean, we sound like we're being partisan in this, I think, but it's just an explanation of what's going on. Right. My real fear is that there's a nihilism now in parts of American politics and in parts of American culture, whether it's the war, the culture war over masks and vaccinations, or the kind of old guardrails are gone. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a danger of kind of crashing either through miscalculation or willfully. Some of these, again, your Madison Cawthorns or Marjorie Taylor Greens might say, yeah, let's crash it. Let's do it.
See what happens, right?
Let's see what happens.
You know, and just thinking about why we're reaching the debt ceiling now, it's a combination of two things. One is the pandemic, which has caused all kinds of economic problems and obviously huge amounts of spending that went along with the pandemic. But the other thing is the Trump-era tax cuts.
Yep.
That's why we've reached the debt ceiling. So we're paying for those tax cuts, and the people who voted for those tax cuts are saying, actually, no, we're not interested in paying that bill that we ran up for you know, tax cuts for wealthy people. So how do we get out of this? And there's some solution. How do we get out of this cycle? Because it seems like this is dominating American politics.
It is dominating America. And if the United States crashes, the economy crashes over this, it will be a total own goal. It will be a self-inflicted and unnecessary catastrophe. So how do we get out of it? There's one other Western democracy that has a debt limit. It's Denmark. But they've set their debt limit so high, it's an order of magnitude larger than the economy, that they'll never breach it. So that would be one thing Congress could do. They could just make it a huge number.
Yeah, this time. Gazillion dollars.
Yeah.
Make up a fake number.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. David, I want to hand over to you for the $1 trillion coin, though, which is another thing. Hashtag mint the coin. Explain this.
I will try to explain the mint the coin solution as best I can. So this is an idea that actually came up originally in 2011. During that, was it fights over the debt ceiling before? And the idea behind it basically is this. So most of the money in circulation is issued by the Federal Reserve. So all the paper money you have is issued by, but the coins are issued by the mint. And Congress, their law says that the mint's able to issue coins and gold and silver and various things, and in platinum. And they can issue the gold and silver coins, I think, in various sort of denominations. But the platinum, it says
there's a limit to the denominations for gold and silver.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. But for platinum, they can issue commemorative coins in platinum, at least according to legislation, in any value they want, right? And I think the law was designed, I think, for commemorative coins for stupid things, not for solving national financial crises. But theoretically, you could issue a single coin that is worth $1 trillion, or $100 trillion, or an infinite amount of money. And then say, look, now the government has a lot more money. We can pay off that amount of debt with that coin.
So theoretically, they would have to take the coin from the mint.
Yes, which is part of the Treasury,
to the Federal Reserve and deposit it.
Yeah.
So this is our...
Yeah, and so then we have $1 trillion or whatever value you want.
So why is this? I mean, President Obama dismissed this as a wacky idea.
And Janet Yellen, the current Secretary of the Treasury, said, like, we've looked into this. Also kind of a wacky idea. And, like, we shouldn't solve national problems by absolving Congress of its responsibility to pay for the things they wanted to pay for. And, you know, Biden's been asked about it in press conferences. But the fact that people keep asking about it suggests something. I'm not quite sure what. It seems to me like a crazy, stupid idea, even if it might actually work on a technical level. That's probably not how we want to be managing the global economy.
So if this were the Hollywood movie or the Netflix series, this is where you say to me, it's so crazy,
it just might work. Exactly. Well, I think it's... Yes, because I mean, and what the financial consequences would be for inflation and for other credit and other kinds of things of issuing a platinum coin. Then what happens if the platinum coin gets lost? Can you go to, like...
Falls behind a
couch. Exactly.
Well, it also just...
Where did a $1 trillion platinum coin go?
Where did I leave mine? But it also... I'm sorry. It makes us...
Look
it
like
makes,
it is.
We're like clowns. I mean, well, it's not a functioning... government, if
that implies, frankly, that we don't already look like clowns.
Okay, all right.
So
fair
Congress has been perfecting that for years. So that's a solution people have proposed. A better solution, I think, actually goes back to the 14th Amendment, where it says that the U.S. debt is somewhat sacred, and it will not be questioned, which. One could read potentially as meaning that the debt ceiling is unconstitutional. That if the Congress authorizes spending that takes us into debt, we will pay off that debt because it says in the Constitution that we will pay off that debt. That might be a way that you could, you know, through the courts, get rid of the debt ceiling.
What would have to happen, though? Somebody would have to sue. Would have to... And who would they say?
Well, so, okay, here, well,
so
here's...
How would that, I mean, I'm interested in that idea, but how would it work?
Well, here's the way it could work. And it's not a good way. Let's imagine that they crash and burn, they exceed the debt ceiling, and they don't pay off somebody's bond, right? And the person goes into the court and says, I have a bond that's for whatever value of money. Constitution says the debt shall be paid. That the Congress's actions in creating the debt ceiling originally were unconstitutional. I want my money back.
But in that scenario, the damage has to be
done
before
first.
Right.
Yeah, well, it's like most things. You have to have the damage happen before you can have the legal solution to it. So.
Right. I mean, because I suspect if the United States went over the precipice, then the economic catastrophe that would ensue would result in some sort of legislative solution. They would set the debt limit at such a high figure, you know, a la Denmark or whatever, that we wouldn't have to do this again. Again, the problem is the kind of divergence here between sound economic and fiscal policy and politics. And frankly, this is good politics for the people who are willing to take the country to the brink.
Yeah.
I think it works for them.
I mean, and the things that if you look at what the Secretary of the Treasury have been doing, going all the way back to 1995, is every time we get close to reaching these debt ceilings, they start to go into sort of like panic budget mode, but how do we stretch the little bit of money that we have left to spend to last as long as we possibly can, you know? And it seems crazy that the Secretary of the Treasury and all the people who work in that department are spending a huge amount of time and energy trying to, you know, stretch their budget to make ends meet when they don't need to.
For the government of what, for the moment, remains the richest
country
in the world.
in the richest country not only in the world, but in the history of the world, it feels like they're saying, like, can we use coupons this year? Like how can we pay for that? And
turn the heat off!
Exactly. Let's all put on sweaters. That's how we're going to deal with getting an extra 4 hours worth of, you know, and that's the kinds of steps they were taking, trying to figure out, like, okay, if we send out the Social Security checks, like, on a Friday, they won't get it because of my mail until Monday, and give us an extra day. And like, no, we don't need
to post-date the checks.
Exactly. You know, but the fact that the Treasury Department's dealing with those kinds of things suggests that this whole thing is a problem. The bigger problem, I mean, there's lots of problems with this, is that Congress has spent the past 2 weeks just dealing with this stupid issue. it's a meaningful issue, but like it's not a problem, you know, when in fact they have huge things they could have been dealing with. They could have been dealing with, you know, both of the infrastructure bills, which are very important and, you know, needed. And I think even Republicans agree that one of them might be needed. They could be dealing with climate change. They could be dealing with any number of real substantive problems. But they instead have been, you know, forced to deal with this, you know, a bureaucratic sort of loophole that we're sort of stuck in, the loop that we're stuck in.
Yeah, and an element of this, which I don't think we have time to get into today because we've gone on long enough about this, is Mitch McConnell's determination that even if the Democrats are able to get out of this mess, and I think they probably will be in December, they have to use reconciliation to solve it, and that requires about 2 weeks of time to do it, which is to say, I don't think we can go into it right now, but there will be no Republican cooperation, so the Democrats will have to use their very slim majorities to end this mechanism called budget reconciliation in order to get get it passed. And that's just Mitch McConnell gumming up the works and making them go through the motions. But that would take another 2 weeks of time that could be spent on other matters, frankly, as opposed to just everybody voting in favor of this, which is, for those, the 100 times in the past century or the 78 times since 1960 is normally what happened.
Yeah. Like, do you vote to pay your credit card bill? Yes, you pay your credit card bill.
And then you move on to the next thing.
Right. It's not even, shouldn't even be a question. All right.
I think there are implications for the filibuster, and I think we may return to reconciliation and the filibuster, but we don't have time today.
But I think this is one of the sort of, it's become a tool, just like those things have to make government work less well. And I think it's sort of part of why Washington is as inefficient in dealing with substantive issues as it is because there's all these sort of levers that one could push.
Well, the United States has a constitution has evolved, or the government has evolved, so that relatively small minorities, whether they're legislative minorities or representing areas of the country with relatively small populations, wield outsized influence and have developed techniques and bureaucratic weapons that give them outsized power.
Yeah.
And this is one of several manifestations of that.
I think that's been a theme of like half of our episodes and going past 4 or 5. So time for last drops, Frank. Let's go with off for something better than the budget crisis and debt ceiling nonsense.
I want to promote the upcoming Fennell Forum. Careful listeners of this podcast will know that the Fennell Lectures are the Fennell Lecture is the high profile lecture in history at the University of Edinburgh. Sponsored by a generous alumnus, Simon Fennell. And we've recently introduced something called the Fennell Forum, which we're holding once a year. And the Fennell Forum brings together historians and people who've been involved in the lectures to discuss matters of import to historians, of interest to historians. And so there's an upcoming Fennell Forum, which will be chaired by Patrick Griffin from the University of Notre Dame, who gave the Fennell Lecture several years ago. And Patrick's going to convene a conversation with some of our colleagues, Sonia Tycho, who's an incoming historian of labor, who's joining us in January. Sven Johannesson, who's a postdoctoral fellow in American history with us, and Emily Brownell, who's they're going to address the question. They're speaking in early November, November 9th at 6 p.m. UK time. They will be talking about the climate crisis and history and how historians. Both how the climate crisis might affect the study of history, but also what historians might have to add to the to debates about the climate crisis and discussions about the way ahead.
And how much would one need to spend in order to attend said Fennell Forum?
Absolutely nothing, because it's a virtual event. And tickets are available. We'll share the link in the show page. Thank you for suggesting, for reminding me of that, David. So you've got your ticket today.
I've already got my ticket. I will sell it to anyone who wants.
All right.
You have a buddy.
He's a speculator like Alexander Hamilton.
Exactly.
So the Fennell Forum, let me sum up. So it's on History and the Climate Crisis, November 9th at 6 p.m. UK time. And it's a virtual event, and you are welcome to attend.
I'm very much looking forward to that.
What's your last drop, David?
There was a story that came out yesterday and I found fascinating. It comes out of the University of Virginia, where a group there did some interesting quantitative analysis and found a correlation between places in the American South that put up monuments to the Confederacy and places in the American South that had lynchings. You know, we think about what do these monuments mean? What are they supposed to intend? Are they not racist symbols? You know, this correlation at least suggests, and many of these monuments are coming out, are erected at this, you know, moment between 1890 and 1920, when lynching was an endemic in the American South, and they find a strong correlation at least between these two phenomena. They did all kinds of things for controlling for population size and various other things. So it's a fascinating study. It was actually not done by a bunch of historians, and they make some claims in their press release that are slightly dubious, but it's, you know, they have some very interesting data. I'm looking forward to sort of digging into it some more.
Excellent.
Great.
Cheers, David.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.